And you'll see on the inside of the service sheet this, I think, rather cool graphic that Neil has designed for the series. And you have to look at it closely to see what it's doing. When bad things happen to good people. I like it because you don't see it straight away and you have to sort of puzzle about the image. And then you puzzle about the question. What happens when bad things happen to good people? Job's a good guy. And he has a terrible, terrible time. And, you know, you don't have to search far, do you, to find the resonances of this question in our own lives. Imagine you've enjoyed relative stability over the last 20 years where you live in Afghanistan. There's been great changes to education and to freedom for women in particular. Things have been more peaceful. The army has been trained to keep law and order. It's been going really well. And then in the space of a week, you're running for your life. You're cramming to get into an airport with everybody else pretty much in the whole city. And then a bomb is detonated just outside the gate. And many people are killed, including those who are there just to try and help other people to get out. What's going on? Or you're a doctor and you graduate from Cambridge University with a first in medicine, and you decide that you don't really want to work in a sort of glamorous hospital. You prefer to work with people who are quite needy and overlooked. So you go and become a geriatric doctor in a hospital up north. And many of your patients have Parkinson's disease. That's your specialty. And then in your late 30s, you are also diagnosed with Parkinson's. Really, really young. And of course, because it's your expertise, you know all of the consequences of it and what it's going to mean for you. And already you're beginning to see some of the effects as you deteriorate year after year. Or you go to a wedding. We've had lots of those recently and been very happy occasions. I mean, the most happy occasion. And people are gathered for the wedding and the reception's a great party. And then someone walking out of the reception in central London is stabbed. Just by a mugger. These are all examples from the last week that I've come across sort of personally or secondhand, at least from somebody that I know. You don't have to go far, do you, in our world to ask this question. Why do bad things happen, really bad things happen, to good people? Like, there looks like there's this kind of moral chaos in the world. And of course, it asks lots of people to ask the question, well, how can there possibly be a good God in this case? It doesn't look like the person in charge of the universe is doing his job properly. And people can live a good life and then they can really suffer. Famously, the philosopher David Hume, a Scottish philosopher, anti-Christian, he pointed to suffering as the big reason why you couldn't believe in a good God. He put it this way: were a stranger to drop of a sudden into this world, I would show him as a specimen of its ills, a hospital full of diseases. Can relate to that, can't we, in COVID times? A prison crowded with malefactors and debtors, a battlefield strewed with carcasses. Well, that's just Kabul, isn't it, this week? A fleet foundering in the ocean. A nation languishing under pestilence or tyranny. And he said, I can't see how you could square that with an ultimate purpose of good. What is going on? How come bad things happen to good people? And I think the book of Job is, that's kind of what it's about. Job is a really, really good guy. And the chapter keeps telling us that. And really, really bad things happen to him. And we're asking, what is going on? So that's really the question. I hope you can relate to it. And I guess it's just everywhere, isn't it? It's around every corner. It's in every news story. It's every friend. And it might even be your own life at the moment. Real trouble, real evil coming upon you. What is going on? I want to say that the answer of Job chapters 1 and 2, it's a very striking and surprising answer. And I've preached on it before, actually, but I came back to it this last week. And again, it surprised me just what an unusual answer it's going to be and what a distinctively Christian answer it's going to be. As in, I think if you were an atheist, you wouldn't accept this answer. Now, I want to go on the front foot as well. I don't think atheists have got a better answer. So, you know, why do bad things happen to good people? Well, they're just random. I mean, everything's random. I mean, if you're an atheist, you can't even really ask a moral question in an intelligible way. I mean, it's just, don't ask why about a universe that's here by chance. Doesn't that make sense to ask why? There isn't a reason why. No one's in charge of the controls of the universe. So I don't think the atheists got a better answer really, but I don't think they'll accept this answer. And Virginia Woolf, you may know, was a famous novelist, one of the most important writers in the early 20th century. And for some reason, I remembered this. I used to have a book of quotations at home, and this is what I remembered, even though I wasn't a Christian at the time I read it. She said, I read the book of Job recently, and I don't think God comes out of it very well. And I think if you're a skeptic, you may not be impressed with God in this chapter. I think we need to come with faith, if we're Christians, and be willing to accept a very strange take or a very unexpected take on suffering in the world. So I'm basically trying to build up suspense. Let's dive in. We've got 4 points, and that point three is by far the longest. I'm telling you that in case you're thinking, how long is this sermon going to go on for? And you realize that we've got quite a way to go. But one and two are quite short, and three is going to take the most time. But number one, first thing to say is, in this question of bad things happening to good people, Job is the model. He's the guy who gets it right. He's the guy we're supposed to copy. And I just want to prove that to you, because you know, people have questions over Job a bit later on. But he definitely is a good guy, according to the author of the book. Right. So the Holy Spirit inspiring the book of Job. Then the narrator thinks Job is a good guy. Verse 1, chapter 1, verse 1. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. That man was blameless and upright. He feared God and turned away from evil. That's what the narrator thinks. That's what the Holy Spirit inspiring the author thinks. And it's also what God thinks. Verse 8. The Lord said, have you considered Job? There's no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns from evil. So it's the narrator's verdict and it's God's verdict. And then it's God's verdict again in chapter 2, verse 3. He still holds to this. Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns from evil. So you see that he's a good guy, according to the Bible narrator and according to God. And if that isn't enough, I mean, it should be enough, shouldn't it? If God thinks that and the Holy Spirit thinks that, God the Father thinks that. But also the Apostle James thinks that. So if you turn to the book of James, we don't have to turn to it now, but he says in James chapter 5 in the New Testament, as an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spake in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You've heard of the steadfastness of Job. You've seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. Okay, so Job is the hero. He's the poster boy for suffering, maybe because he suffers the most of really anybody imaginably, but also because he responds to suffering the best. And we'll see that as the chapter goes on. But this is what Job's got right at the beginning. And I love this description. This is very briefly. I love it. He's blameless and upright. That means he lives the kind of good life that everyone acknowledges is good. So, you know, no one's got anything on him. I was reminded of, I've been to various weddings this summer of Grace Church Greenwich people. And one of them, the best man, you know, always trying to dig the dirt on the groom. And he basically said, I'm really sorry. I really done my best. I really have done my best. But there just wasn't anything I could find to throw at this guy. That's what it means to be blameless. I mean, it's a bit of a disappointment for the best man speech. But it was, you know, that's what Job's friends said about him. They couldn't blame him. He had a good reputation in the eyes of everybody. He was blameless and upright. And he feared God. That's going to be a big thing in Job, as indeed it's a big thing in all of the wisdom literature in the Old Testament, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Job's, that the fear of the Lord. And we'll see that that gets tricky as the book goes on. To still trust God, to still humble yourself before God when you do not understand what God is up to. But that is what Job does. He fears God. He remembers God's up there and I'm down here. and I need to be humble before him. And we would do well to have that attitude even as we come to this book, I think, to fear God. And then the last thing that is my favorite, that he turns from evil. So it is not that he never does evil or never thinks evil or never says evil, because there's only one person like that, and it's the Lord Jesus. All of us are sinful people. But Job is marked by repenting from it. He turns from it. So he sometimes does stuff wrong. But the reason he's blameless is because when he's got stuff wrong, he confesses and he turns away from it. And the New Testament tells us we should be the same. We need to repent, not just once when we become Christians, but every day. So I've done stuff wrong today, Lord. I turn away from it. I want to turn back to you. Please forgive me. And that's what Job does. He's a great guy. That's basically the headline. Job is great. He's a really good guy. He's a good person. But really, really bad stuff happens to him. And we've heard it read, but let's summarize what happens. Verse 13. There was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And a messenger came and said, the oxen were plowing, the donkeys feeding, and the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword. And I'm the only one left. He's escaped. And while he was speaking, another person came and said, fire of God fell from heaven and burned the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell ye. While he was speaking, another one came and said, the Chaldeans formed three groups and made a raid on the camels and took them and struck down the servants to the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell ye. While he was speaking, another one came and said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came upon the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they're dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you. And Job got up, tore his clothes, which is the Bible way of saying, I'm very, very upset. Imagine him doing it. I mean, I would do it now, but I like the shirt. But imagine, you know, you're just ripping your clothes. It's a sort of extreme response of emotional anguish. And he falls on the ground. He shaves his head. I haven't done that because I'm anguished, but for other reasons. But Job, with a full head of hair, shaves it all off. And he falls on the ground and worships God and says, God, you're still God. But I'm very, very sad. I mean, it's awful, isn't it? I mean, he's an unbelievably blessed man in verse 2. He's very wealthy. He's got a great family. He's got seven sons, three daughters, 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and lots of servants. And then in reverse order, all of those things get taken away. So he's got donkeys and oxen, but then he loses them to the Sabaeans, to a military raid from a hostile group. And then he's got lots of sheep, but he loses them because of fire from heaven. They're struck by lightning. And then he's got lots of donkeys and he loses them because another raiding party comes. And then he's got lots of children and he loses them. He loses his wealth and you think, who cares? No, I can do without some sheep. And then he loses his kids. It's just an awful thing. And then in round two, in chapter two, he loses his own health. And he's covered with blistering sores. And he scrapes himself with a bit of pottery and sits in the dust. He suffers terribly. And even his wife can't understand it. Job, you'd be better off dead. You know, why don't you just curse God and he'll kill you as well? And then it'll be over. Like, how are you even coping with this, Job? And his friends, when they show up, they're so shocked that they're speechless. They want to be with him, but they just haven't got a single word to say. I mean, and I guess, you know, this isn't fairy tale, is it? Maybe you know people who have just suffered suffering upon suffering upon suffering. I can think of somebody whose father was really badly bullied and, you know, has had all sorts of trauma from bullying in the past. And then his mother had just been struck with cancer. Of course, it's one thing on top of another. It's the same person. And again, this isn't fairy stories. People know examples like this. You know examples like this. You know people like this. And they're good people. And terrible things happen. Okay. And in a way, we're just setting the stage. I mean, we know this. But it's really, you know, this is an example of that in extreme. But then here is the very surprising and unique take on it that you'll only find in the Bible. Point three. Job's suffering plays out on a heavenly stage that he doesn't see. And it's the same for us. Right? So in chapter one, and you'll notice this as we're hearing it, and in chapter two, it happens twice. We get a glimpse, not down on earth at Job and his suffering, but up in heaven and a discussion that's happening about him. And it's happening, it's in God's courtroom, and various angels are turning up and speaking. They're called the sons of God, sort of heavenly beings. And Satan, that is the devil, shows up. And God asks Satan, what are you doing here? And he says, well, I've just been wandering around, sliding around as I do. And God says, well, consider Job. And as we heard in the kids talk, God says, Job, yeah, of course, Job's your friend. Because after all, he's got 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels and 500 yoke of oxen and 500 female donkeys. And he's got seven sons and three daughters. I mean, of course, he's a Christian. Because look how well it's going for him. Does Job fear God for nothing? Says Satan. And then God says, well, why don't you test him and see? Stretch out your hand and take all he has, but you can't take his life. Now, I want us just to spend some time thinking about this, because it is a sort of very extraordinary glimpse. We don't normally know what's happening in heaven. There's a couple of places in the Bible that we're shown a scene a bit like this. And we don't normally get to see, and importantly, Job doesn't get to see. He doesn't know about this. But we as the readers get an insight into what is really going on a bigger heavenly stage. Now, this does not make any sense to the atheist, because the atheist doesn't even believe there is a heavenly stage. But if you think that all that we are is atoms, then you don't think that there's a God. And you don't think there's a heaven, and you don't think there's a devil, and you know, this is therefore you don't have this perspective, because you just reject it immediately. But the Bible thinks there is a God, and the Bible thinks there is a devil, and just occasionally we get a glimpse onto the fact that what's happening down here is not the be-all and end-all of the universe. We get a rare peek at what is going on in a much bigger arena. And that's helpful, isn't it? Because, of course, we always try and make sense of things down here. Like, why would God let a bomb go off by a gate when people are trying to evacuate from Kabul? Or why would my friend, who's a Parkinson's doctor, get Parkinson's in his 30s? And you can't make sense of it. And we assume that we've got the whole picture, and we can't make sense of it. And immediately Job says, you haven't got the whole picture. At the very least, it tells us that. You do not even know what is going on in heaven. And we assume that our lives and the earth are the center of everything. And it says that they're not. And there just might be a bigger picture that we don't understand. It's the first thing to notice. And it invites us to look into the way in which the universe is governed. And again, this maybe will surprise us. I've got some slides that Paola's going to kick up for me, I think, on the screen. So this is how the atheist thinks the world is governed. Like, it just isn't, right? So there's just a world. And then there's human beings who came back by chance, and we just make the best of it. But random things happen. We can't control them. We do our best. You know, that's an atheist view. It's not a Christian view. The next one is some people think this is the Christian view, right? So let me just explain it. You've still got a world and you've got a person. Maybe that's Job. And then you've got a crown. I've got to explain it because my drawing's so bad. But the crown, people think that represents God. And then next to the crown is, can anyone work out what it is? Satan, it's a snake. It's the best I could do, drawing a reptile. And people think, well, maybe God and the devil sort of equally battle it out to control the world. You know, so it's like sort of Islamic State versus the SAS. And sometimes the SAS get the upper hand, and sometimes Islamic State, K, get the upper hand. And it's a sort of an equal battle between the two of them. Good versus evil. It's not the atheist view. We believe in the real spiritual dimension. But actually, this isn't the Christian view either. So that's wrong, because the devil is not God's equal. There's only one creator in the universe. There's only one Lord and ruler of the universe. So some people, being a bit more sort of theologically aware, they think, well, that's not the right view of the universe. It's actually this one. Can we go the other way? No, there's one other picture, I think. Oh, sorry, no, that is, sorry, I was wrong. No, it was the right one. Okay, one more. Sorry, I'm getting confused. That is the right one. People think this is right. Sorry, Pele. Okay, so there's only one ultimate ruler, which is God. And there's us here on earth, and God decides everything that happens. But that isn't quite right either. And I got confused because I'm so used to this diagram. I think the book of Job actually has this. Okay, there is God, he's in charge. And there is a real devil who is involved. And there is us down here on earth. Now, I was on holiday in Scotland last week. And they got to do a Bible study with the kids who were up there on holiday, the sort of older children, aged 11 to 16 or so. And we had a time where they could just sort of ask me any question they wanted, and I'd do my best to find the answer in the Bible. And one of them said, where does evil come from? I think they asked it because they knew it was a really hard question. But fortunately, I was preparing Job, or I'd been preparing Job, and I said, well, I'll tell you the answer in Job. There's two things to say, and I asked the children two questions, and maybe you can answer them. I said, are good and evil, are God and the devil equals in this chapter? And the children said, no. You see, that? Well, then how do you know they're not equals? What do you answer? How did you know that God and Satan are not equal, opposite, sort of good versus evil? Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Excellent answer. God, Satan is only able to do what God permits him to do. And Satan can only do it up to limits that God sets. You can take what he's got, but you can't take his life. So, you know, Satan doesn't have a free hand. He is under God's rule. They're not equals. But also, my second question was, are God and Satan friends? And they're not friends. I mean, Satan is there opposing God, accusing God, demeaning God. Ha! You think Job's your friend for nothing? Come off it. It's those sheep you've given him, and that family, and all those donkeys. That's why he cares about you, God. He scoffs, and he mocks, and he accuses. In fact, his name means in Hebrew, accuser. That's what the word Satan means. And he is God's enemy. And so you put these things, two things together, and you get an insight in how the universe works. There is a God who is the only ultimate ruler. And yet he has an enemy who opposes him and mocks him and accuses his people. There's a kind of fight going on between God and Satan. It's a fight that God has sort of already won because he's already in charge, but nonetheless there's a fight. And you see this actually everywhere in the Bible. God and Satan are not equals. God's much more powerful, but God and Satan are not friends. They're on opposite sides. And you could just think to yourself, I think I could find, you know, four or five places just off the top of my head where you see the same thing working out in the Bible. You see, I mean, for example, look at the death of Jesus. God and Satan are not friends. The devil is against Jesus. He tempts him, he opposes him, and yet God and evil are not equals, because Satan can do nothing to thwart Jesus' plan as he goes to the cross in order to drive out Satan. Now that's how the universe is governed, and I think it has these implications. Three characters: the Lord rules, he's in charge. Satan accuses, he's God's enemy. And Job is the one who is on trial. And I think this is really extraordinary. I want to try and give an analogy. Let's imagine, and rather than bring it down from heaven, which we don't have much experience of discussions in heaven, I thought I'd try and find a kind of equivalent down on earth. And it's not a brilliant equivalent, but it goes a bit like this. Imagine there's sort of some family feud. And one branch of your family says, oh, the Satches, or, you know, whoever you are, they're all liars. All of you lie. You're a bunch of liars. Whereas the whatever this other branch of family is, you know, we're not like that. And this feud happens between the sort of parents. And then in answer to the feud, mum and dad Satch say, no, we're not liars. I mean, look at Andrew, for example. Now, what's happened in that argument is I've been put on trial as an, you know, truth-telling person. And my parents have staked the credibility of their family on me. Or, you know, you think of another example, you can say, I don't want to do it with actual names in the church, but the Smiths or the Joneses or some generic name, they're so lazy. No, they're not lazy. I mean, look at Hector. And they cite their sort of football playing athletic son. Now, okay, in that kind of argument, it's a stupid example. We can probably kind of relate to that. In that kind of argument, all eyes are on me to catch me lying. And if I'm caught lying, my parents end up losing face and look stupid because they said, look at Andrew, he's not a liar. How can you say the Satch is a liar? Look at him. Or in this sort of ridiculous example, if Hector is caught like getting up late or stuffing his face with fish and chips or something, and they can get it on camera, or just staying on the sofa all night or something. You know, I told you they were lazy. Now, I mean, it's a silly example, but I hope we can kind of understand it. Imagine it in heaven, and this is the reality. God's having an argument with Satan, and God stakes his reputation on you. Or on Andrew, or on Paolo, or on Julia, and Hang. So Satan is saying, oh, all of your people, God, they're all frauds. They don't really love you. They're just in it for what they can get. Just because you bless them, that's the only reason they're Christians. Look at how good their lives are. But if their lives were bad, they'd curse you to your face. No, God says, no, they wouldn't. No, look at Hang. Look at Judah, look at Job. Now, I think this is the one thought for this week, really, that's just extraordinary as a perspective on suffering. Your reaction to suffering could be part of an argument on a much bigger stage that you don't see, in which God's credibility is pinned on how you respond. Now, I mean, this is mind-blowing for me because I've often said to people, don't judge Christianity by the behavior of Christians, because Christians have done some stupid and awful things. I sometimes say, don't judge a movement by its misrepresentatives. I say, you know, you wouldn't judge the NHS by the actions of Howard Shipman. I mean, yeah, he was a serial killer, but that doesn't mean that all doctors are serial killers. You know, don't judge someone by their misrepresentatives. And when it comes to Christianity, judge it by Jesus. Because, you know, he's pretty good. And you look at him pretty closely and he'll come out pretty well. But it makes me really uncomfortable that in this book, God doesn't say, look at Jesus. I mean, elsewhere he does that, of course. But he goes, look at ordinary Christian Job. Look at Adrian. Like, imagine Adrian is the subject of an argument in heaven where God's staking his own credibility on Adrian's faith being real. And we don't get to see that. We don't know about that argument. And we just think, I'm really suffering. But do you see, it really, really matters how Job responds to this. If Job says, well, God, I loved you when I had oxes and donkeys and a big family, but now I've got none of it, I hate you. Satan goes, ha, 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 ha. So I told you, see, I went, God, you're a fraud. All of your people are frauds. Christian faith is just a way of getting a leg up. That's all it is. But if a Christian, when they suffer, when everything is taken away from them, they still trust God. They don't know why. They don't understand. But they say, look, God is good. He gives everything I have. He takes away what he's taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Now, that is an amazing testimony to God's faithfulness and to the reality of faith. I mean, it really is an amazing testimony. It's a testimony to people on earth, isn't it? I mean, think of Jeremy Marshall, who many of us know and love. He spoke at our Skeptics Guides week in the middle of lockdown. Had cancer for about 7 years. He shouldn't really be alive still. Had so many different doses of chemo and somehow still going. And in all that suffering, he sounds a bit like Job. Oh, blessed be the name of the Lord, he says. Full of joy, telling everybody about. I mean, that is an amazing. It's hard to dismiss that, isn't it? When the person is actually suffering. And I can think of Christians in various situations like that. Christians who've lost children, most unthinkable. Christians who've lost their own health. Christians who've experienced real tragedy, and yet they love Jesus. They trust him. Very powerful. And Job tells us it might matter not only on earth, but even on a canvas or in a stadium that we don't see, a stage. We assume that, you know, the earth is all that matters, this little planet. And it turns out, no, it's just a little tiny part of the universe. And there's a whole heavenly arena of people discussing what's going on earth, at which God's reputation's at stake, and he's staked it on us. And when a Christian perseveres under trial, God looks really good. What's the outcome? Well, in Job's case, as I said, he is a model. He's a model because he will not curse God. That seems to be the biggest fear. It's Job's fear in verse 5 about his own kids. They party all night. I guess it's kind of common, isn't it, for children of a very prosperous family. I mean, Job's done really well in his family party. That's kind of often what happens. It's sort of made in Chelsea kind of territory. And Job is just, his one concern is, what if my children sin and curse God? That's what he doesn't want. He doesn't want them to turn their backs on God. So he's always praying for them, always sacrificing for them. And then Job himself, he's very upset. He tears his clothes. He shaves his head. He falls flat on the ground, but he still worships. The Lord gave, the Lord's taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And then the author tells us, verse 22, in all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. He did not charge God with God wrong. And then even his wife says, come on, Job, enough's enough. You know, what on earth is God doing? Curse God and die. And he won't. He says, you're sounding crazy, darling. You're sounding crazy. You know, should we accept good things from God and not when he decides to give us hard things? And again, the narrator says, in all this, Job did not sin with his lips. What matters most, if you can kind of get into this mindset, and as I said, it's very foreign and strange to us. And if you weren't a Christian, you probably can't make sense of it at all, like Virginia Woolf. But if you can get your head into this, what ends up mattering most in Job? It actually isn't how much he suffers. That is not the most important thing. The critical thing is, when he suffers, will he curse God? Will he turn away from God? Because that's what Satan is predicting he will do. And that's what God says he won't do. Look at Job. And I think, my little points in under point 4 with suspense, the Lord is vindicated. He's right. There really are true Christians, true believers. And Satan is humiliated because he's wrong. And Job is faithful. He is a blameless, upright man who fears God and turns from evil. And I hope the application is obvious. Job is our model. He's the poster boy. This is how to suffer. And whatever happens in your suffering, and it might be you can't make sense of it, and Job doesn't even get to see what's going on, really, in the universe. And so often in suffering, we do not get to see. But the really big question is, are we going to be faithful? Or are we going to curse God? prove Satan right, demean God's glory, or we continue to fear God, and God is vindicated, and Satan is humiliated, and in the end, God will bless those who are faithful to him. It really matters, doesn't it? And I think this is why it's so profound for me. A different thing really matters than the thing I thought really mattered. You know, if you're suffering, what do you think really, really matters when you're suffering? You think the suffering really matters. It has to stop. Like, I mean, it's understandable because it really hurts. But Job says something matters even more than that. Will you, in your suffering, lose your faith? Be hostile, resentful towards God. Turn away from him. Trust him less. Give the devil a win. Or will you, and so many Christians I've seen do, love Jesus, trust Jesus, praise Jesus, bring great honor to Jesus. The Lord has given, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord.